I think what Amazon has done is taken one of their core skills, which is looking at the network, married that with technology, and really continued to focus on this idea of last mile delivery. They do a really good job of staying focused on the things that they're really good at, like logistics. This, to me, is a perfect example of working from the customer back.
Welcome to Supply Chain Now, the number one voice of supply chain. Join us as we share critical news, key insights, and real supply chain leadership from across the globe, one conversation at a time.
Hey, everybody. Good morning, good afternoon, good evening, wherever you may be. Scott Luden and always special guest Mike Griswold here with you on Supply Chain Now. Welcome to today's show. Hey, Mike, how you doing today?
I'm doing well, Scott. It's hard to believe we're already the first week in June. So,
bam.
I don't know where it's going, but it's gone by fast.
It sure has. It sure has. But I hear good things that the smart AI technologies out there are working hard to give us time back. We'll see how that plays out, Mike.
Yes.
That'd be welcome, yes. Wouldn't it?
It would. I think there's always a, you know, we will wait and see kind of how all that plays out.
Always is. But folks, today, all that aside, we continue one of our longest running and most popular series here, Supply Chain Today and Tomorrow, with the one and only Mike Griswold with Gartner. Mike, of course, serves as Vice President Analyst with Gartner. And we got a great show teed up here today, folks. We're going to be checking in to see what a few members of the Gartner Supply Chain Top 25 have been up to. In particular, we're going to check in with all four of the masters from the 2024 list. That we're talking Amazon, Apple, P&G, and Unilever. Now, the new top 25 for 2025 is just around the corner. In fact, by the time this publishes, you might be able to check out the new list, which is chock full of great examples. But stay tuned as we walk through an outstanding discussion with Mike Griswold. All right, so Mike, before we get there, you know, I don't have the fun warm-up quiz today that we've had a lot of fun with in the last few months, but I've got a cool question for you, one that I bet you and I can both relate to. So on this date in 1977, the VHS format is introduced in North America at a trade show in Chicago. I think that was CES there in Chicago before it moved to Vegas. Now, eventually, as we all know, or a lot of folks know, VHS would eventually win the heads-up battle against the evil Betamax for market domination. Thanks to VHS's advantages like longer playtime, faster rewinding, back when you had to be kind and rewind, and the ability to fast forward. Betamax couldn't offer that from what I've looked at. So all of that, of course, would pave the way to the golden age of VHS rental stores, which were prevalent across the U.S. at least in the 80s and into the early 90s. So, Mike, with that history lesson as a backdrop, what's one of your favorite video rental memories from way back in the day?
Well, I think growing up in a small town, you know, we never had Blockbuster or any of those types of places. It was, as I'm sure many people experienced, right? It was tucked into your favorite grocery store, tucked into your favorite drugstore. I think for me, it was always fascinating. I think it was on Tuesdays, it still might be, when the major releases would come out, whether it was a record or in this case, the VHS tapes. And the mad scramble and the lines that would ensue and the waiting list, almost like a library that would ensue because the video store had two copies of Raiders of the Lost Ark, right? That was it. Maybe they had three. And, you know, you wanted to be there to be one of those two or three people. And at worst case, you wanted to get your name early on the waiting list. So this whole idea of lack of supply meeting this pent-up demand for a physical product that, if I go in the Wayback Machine, I think you agreed to a certain length of time, right? 1 day, 2 day, 3 day rentals, maybe, so that at least on the waiting list, you had a sense of kind of when you might be able to see Raiders of the Lost Ark. But it was the very manual nature, even just the product itself, right? Having to hit the play button. You mentioned the rewinding. And there was a cottage industry on just being able to go buy rewinding devices, if you remember that. at your own home, you know, because oftentimes you would, if I couldn't get Raiders of the Lost Ark, I'd rent three or four other movies. And then you wanted to minimize the wear and tear on your VCR in terms of the rewinding. So you had this other little device that was relatively inexpensive, put it in, hit the button, and it would rewind it for you. So yeah, the little things that pop up around that were fascinating.
That is a wonderful walkthrough, a very vivid aspect of so many of our journeys, certainly mine. And look at this. This is what a Friday night might look like. You got some VHS tapes of some of the latest releases and always these big old remote controls. Nothing like the smaller controls we use with our streaming device. Oh, no. Big old thousands of buttons. Didn't know how to work. At least I didn't. And one more thing, Mike. Late fees. I haven't done my research, but I can only imagine. So, folks, if this was before your time, so to speak, if you didn't get that physical videotape back in time, they would charge you for every single day, sometimes like $6 a day whenever you got it back. And that was just, that was money on top of money. Mike, like you said, it was a whole cottage industry of revenue created around VHS tapes, huh?
I can remember not so much the supermarkets, but when you had a Blockbuster, they had that big one-way door where you could drop off your return, your movies after the store was closed. So you'd open it up, slide it in, close it. And I can remember peeking around like on my tippy toes, looking in the window and seeing this monstrous pile that had overflown the little box they put. Overflowing with people who had returned their videos. Because you talk about late fees, you also talk, it was like a buck if you didn't rewind. People complain now about, which I think is a fair complaint, about how much it costs now to check a suitcase, right? A buck to rewind? I mean, talk about easy money.
Seriously, they're going to get you one way or another.
Yes.
Those are some great memories. And I'm going to have to explore more because that market dominated for, it seemed like, about 15, 20 years. Yeah. But anyway, speaking of companies dominating, Gartner Supply Chain Top 25 comes out each year. June, the 2025 version is going to be out in a few weeks. I've already seen the reveal webinar I've signed up for. And each year, Mike, beyond the top 25 of high-performing supply chains, you've got companies called the masters that have been performing at a high level from a supply chain perspective for years now. And they had, actually, I think they created this separate category just for those companies. But tell us more when we talk about the masters, you know, the four companies we're talking about here today. What is that exactly?
Yeah. So we have this separate but distinct category that we have as part of the top 25, as you alluded to, Scott, called the masters. So when we go through the evaluation, you know, the mix of quantitative and qualitative results, we assign every company that gets into the pool, we create a composite score for them. And then we just take all the companies, we rank them high to low based on their composite score. That's how we create the list. The masters were designed to be able to showcase companies that had long-term sustained excellence. So in order to be a master, you have to have a top five composite score 7 of the last 10 years. It's not where you ranked. It's actually what is your composite score. So when we rank those companies in there by their composite score, if a master's company is in that top five for 7 of the last 10 years, then they get a little check that says, yep, you can continue. But as we saw several years ago, unfortunately, with McDonald's, that you can exit the masters if your performance does not maintain that consistency and does not maintain that level of performance that keeps you with that high composite score. So, you know, some people think of it as kind of a lifetime achievement award. Some people have likened it to, you know, putting a jersey in the banner in your favorite sports arena. But that's not the case. Every year, those companies get evaluated, and you really only have 3 years where you can be, you know, kind of substandard compared to where you've been to remain a master. So we think recognition of companies that have really been able to stand the test of time, continue to improve their supply chain in varying situations, you know, the pandemic, things we're going through now, whatever. It is the best of the best.
And to your point, you know, folks have a lot of different takes on top 25, but in my view, what's undeniable are the insights of what these leading companies are doing innovation-wise, overcoming challenge-wise, talent-wise, leadership-wise, and it's chock full of, in my view, things and ideas and practices that companies of any size can take and put in their own organization. So stay tuned for the 2025 version because it's going to be released right around the corner. Okay, so Mike, today I kind of stole from the headlines a bit. You know, we're going to walk through the four masters from 2024. We'll see what 2025 brings us, but we're going to dial it in on Amazon, Apple, P&G, and Unilever. And we're going to start with our friends at the Big A at Amazon. So this is pretty impressive. Check this out. Amazon's making a major investment in its rural delivery infrastructure here in the U.S. So according to the company, it is investing a whopping $4 billion. That's right. B as in Bezos, to expand the rural delivery network across the country. Now, as it seeks to speed up delivery to its customers across small towns everywhere and less densely populated regions across the U.S., the investment is expected to grow Amazon's rural network to over 200 delivery stations and create over 100,000 new jobs like that. When complete, Amazon says that its ability and infrastructure to reach small towns, say, from Milton, Florida to North Pole up in Alaska, well, that ability is going to be tripled. So, Mike, your thoughts around this major investment and play that Amazon's doing here?
A lot of people, I think, downplay some of the things Amazon does because of who Amazon is and the amount of money they have, right? Investing $4 billion in just this, you know, is more than probably most organizations' entire supply chain budget, maybe the exception of someone like Walmart. But one of the topics we talk a lot about at Gartner is this idea of network design. I think one of the many things Amazon does is they don't see network design as kind of a static exercise. They see it as a very fluid exercise. And I think technology has now allowed us to do that. AI certainly can play a role in this. I think organizations that are not looking at their network, you know, maybe not daily or weekly, but clearly at a much more regular frequency than maybe we have in the past, are missing opportunities. I think what Amazon has done is taking one of their core skills, which is looking at the network, married that with technology, and really continued to focus on this idea of last mile delivery. And I think they're a great example of someone that, while at times may succumb to the shiny object phenomenon that everyone is exposed to, right, and succumbs to from time to time, they do a really good job of staying focused on the things that they're really good at, like logistics. Yeah. And I think this idea of recognizing the fact that we've got some underserved customers, right? This to me is a perfect example of working from the customer back. We've got these people, rural communities aren't getting the service that they deserve when they buy our stuff. How do we help with that? And how do we employ more people? Right. It's interesting because I think these are the types of jobs that are primarily going to land, I think, with the drivers, right? People driving those prime vans around, which for the most part, I think, Scott, we would say has not been part of some of the negative press that Amazon has gotten through some of their distribution center facilities, right?
Right, right.
Certainly, they're going to need some hubs, but I think they're going to be much smaller scale. And I think these jobs are going to go, I think, primarily to drivers, right? To get this stuff out. They're providing great opportunities for people, jobs that are, I think, relatively satisfactory from an employee experience perspective. And they're really, I think, leaning into this idea of we've got underserved communities from the standpoint of getting our stuff when everyone else can get it. I think this is going to work out really, really well for them.
A lot of golden nuggets in what you just shared there. And I would just add to one of the comments you made, the notion of customer experience, it's really been around informally for decades, right? In many ways, some people argue supply chain what delivered the customer experience. However, the formal school of modern thought, there are companies that talk about it, and then there's companies that live it. And I tell you, Amazon knows their customer backwards and forwards and are constantly looking for feedback that they don't just take and accumulate, they act on. And Mike, I don't want to pick on any other retailers, but I think a lot of other retailers that were competing with Amazon in its rise perhaps took their customers for granted. And they started, then they started really investing to catch back up. And we've seen some of their competitors make big strides by doing what you said. Start with the customer and go backward from there. You know. So, Mike, your quick comment before I move on to Apple.
It's different, but it's similar to if we go back in the Wayback Machine, even before the VHS discussion we just had, to things like doctors making house calls.
Right.
This is kind of the equivalent of Amazon now saying, hey, you can't necessarily get to the hospital as quickly as you'd like. We're going to bring some of that to you. And yeah, I think the fact that they're willing to invest in that, recognizing that probably initially there's going to be, you know, more cost than probably profit initially. But I think it ultimately is going to pay dividends for them, because now you're going to have scores of customers that maybe didn't purchase or didn't purchase as much or as frequently because it couldn't get to them in the time frame that they wanted. So yeah. I think this is a huge move by them. And it will be interesting, to your point, Scott, to see what other folks in that same predicament, right? Customers that are difficult to get stuff to, what's their reaction to this going to be?
Well said. We're going to see. I love studying the whole retail supply chain game, retail game in general. All right, so we're going to move from Amazon to Apple, who this is really not a news story, but we're going to cover it regardless because it continues to evolve. So Apple has continued to shift production globally, as reported by Supply Chain Digital. And Apple is moving production from China to India and Vietnam. That's not new. Especially focused, though, on U.S.-bound products. That's not that new. However, the efforts have really ramped up, and especially for iPhone production. So these shifts that they're making, which I'm going to give some numbers here in a second, they're reportedly not temporary, but rather holistic changes in overall strategy by Apple. So get this, company CEO Tim Cook said in a recent analyst call that Apple expects the majority of iPhones sold in the U.S. in June 2025 to have India as their company of origin. So they've kind of gotten past the tipping point, perhaps. And for Vietnam, almost all iPad, Mac, Apple Watch, and AirPods is going to have Vietnam as their company of origin. But Apple does expect China to continue to be the country of origin for most product sales outside of the U.S., according to Mr. Cook in that call. Mike, again, these shifts have been going on for quite some time. Your thoughts here?
Yeah, a couple. When you sent over the notes for this, I looked at it and I said, you know what? I'm going to avoid the T word at all possible, but we can't. There is an element of the tariffs behind this, right? And you kicked it off very well, Scott, that this, you know, Tim Cook didn't wake up one morning like yesterday and say, we're going to do all this stuff. These things had been in the works. I think some of the tariff discussions maybe have accelerated some of that.
Right.
And it will be interesting to see if there is an even further migration strategy to really avoid all the tariffs and have some of this stuff made here. But that's probably a conversation for a different day. When I read this story, it just brings me back to things that you and I have talked about numerous times with this, which is this whole idea of risk mitigation. We saw this happen, you know, I think for the first time, people really taking a hard look at risk in general. How do we mitigate risk during COVID? And I think this is just a natural evolution of Apple's kind of risk mitigation playbook, which says, look, you know, for lots of different reasons, we need to diversify where we make stuff. And I think the tariff implications have maybe accelerated some of this, have maybe you know, brought this to the forefront for maybe not necessarily tariff-related reasons. The message here for everyone is to have a constant ongoing review of your risk playbook, contingency planning, and those types of things. The other thing that I know we've talked about, Scott, in the past is moving to these other countries, right? India, Vietnam, you know, Bangladesh, if you're an apparel retailer, some of the Philippines, right? One of the first things you have to take into account is what's the existing infrastructure, right? Can you build a semiconductor plant in India with all the things that need to happen? Can you build that in Vietnam with all of the things that you need to run that? The least of which, frankly, is probably people. Things like water, electricity, right? All those types of things that need to be a constant. Do you have access to that, and can you maintain that? I think what Apple has done certainly has proved that that is scalable in those countries. But I think what it's also done is potentially open the door for other companies. Doesn't have to be an electronics or high-tech company, but for other companies to look at that and say, hey, has Apple started to build already some of that infrastructure that we can now take advantage of and or lessen our costs if we have to upgrade that infrastructure to take care of our capacity? So it keeps coming back to this idea of evaluating risk, building contingency plans, thinking about areas that maybe had not been traditionally thought of as sources of manufacturing, like India as an example. But now they're becoming more of a realistic solution to that. So to me, this really was a great example of a continuous risk management strategy and being able to continue to execute against that over time.
Yes, well said. My phone is just out of reach. I can't pull it up, but with a product that, in fact, this might be the first time my iPhone has been out of reach. I mean, that's just, it's, I've heard some folks say it's just an added appendage these days to the human body. So we'll see. Important, critical, consequential supply chain, and we'll watch these trends as they continue to evolve. All right. This isn't going to be the sexiest segue of all time, Mike, but I do believe packaging is sexy. I want to talk about packaging with you. So check this out. Yeah, I've been saying for years, packaging doesn't get the credit or the airtime that it deserves, especially given how much it influences consumers every single day, especially in brick and mortar stores, right? But don't tell that to the PAC Global Awards, which has been celebrating the packaging value chain ecosystem for 75 years. That's right, 75 years. Now, recently, P&G celebrated a couple of its brands that were recognized for packaging innovation and excellence. Laundry detergent brand Tide, right? You see that on NASCARs everywhere. You're probably using it in your homes. Tide won awards for a product called Tide Evo. Now, this was new to me. This isn't the Tide Pods that y'all have seen out there. This is Tide Evo. It's almost like little tiles. The product comes in certified recyclable paper packaging, eliminating the need for plastic, which is a great thing. That earned sustainability recognition from the PAC Global Awards. And Tide Evo was designed for consumers from all walks of life, including, get this, individuals with disabilities. I love that. So the design process behind Tide Evo earned a best in class for inclusive design. Also, the P&G brand Olay, lotions and cosmetics and the like, Olay earned a best in class packaging award for inclusive design as well. Olay produced the first body wash to include a tactile symbol directly on the bottle, which helps those that are either blind or maybe have other visual challenges in identifying the product via touch. I think that's brilliant. Mike, your thoughts on this element and the power of packaging?
This was a great story that you added here. We have a guy, his name is John Blake. He's been with us for quite some time at Gartner. His primary coverage area is packaging. And he is getting busier and busier talking to companies around things exactly like this. It's interesting. What I found fascinating about this particular story, not surprising, though, with the way P&G thinks about being inclusive and R&D, was the kind of the disability side of this in terms of making products more accessible for people with varying disabilities. The sustainability piece has been going on for a while in terms of people talking about it, people trying to make packaging more sustainable, take plastic out, have less packaging altogether. A lot of our supply chain top 25 companies who have the broader span of control have things like new product design as part of the supply chain. Because if you think about it, how you design a product, size, shape, weight, has incredible impacts on multiple elements of the supply chain. How much space does it take in a truck? How heavy is it in a truck? How much space does it take up in a DC? How many racks and slots do I need? Do I need different equipment to move it around? Because maybe I've made the packaging such that it may not be as sturdy when I move it around a warehouse and put it on a truck and get it to a store or wherever the final destination might be. So there are huge supply chain ramifications to how we design products. I think the fact that P&G has, and again, as I said, not surprisingly, has looked at this now even more broadly than just the sustainability side and taking this to me in a different direction, which is the people that do have, you know, different disadvantages, sight, hearing, whatever it might be, how do we make things that are accessible for them? One of my biggest frustrations now, partly because of my age and partly because of my eyesight, is when I go to a hotel and they have in the shower these three pump bottles with three different things, right? I need to go get my reading glasses to go into the shower to see what is what. And then I have to remember that it's shampoo, conditioner, body wash, or body wash, shampoo, conditioner. I have to remember all that. So I can only imagine how hard it is for someone who maybe is visually challenged to go into a store and have to, you know, either get some assistance or try to figure out for themselves, you know, what product is what. So these types of designs, in some ways, Scott, it comes back to our discussion with Amazon around starting with the customer and working backwards.
Yes. Right?
Amazon started with, like, how do we get stuff to people? I think P&G is starting with, how do people actually interact with our product? Starting with the very first interaction, which is actually touching it. It was great to see P&G with that innovation. And I think P&G is always a little bit ahead of the curve relative to where to take something next, right? So packaging, yes. Sustainability, don't get me wrong, there's still lots of opportunities for lots of companies to do that with this idea around people who have certain disadvantages. I think it's fantastic.
Mike. Well said. And I loved that hotel example that all of us out there can connect, can relate to. And just adding one more layer about packaging, you know, its impact. As you walk through the grocery store and you're comparing products or the packaging or the coloring or the sustainability or the communication on the package appeals to you and impacts your buying decision, right? All of us, every day. And taking it back to the VHS memories we were sharing on the front end. I rented a bunch of video games from the Blockbusters of the world back in the 80s and early 90s. And I can't tell you how many times that the packaging got me. On the front of this video game, it would look like the coolest game with the best graphics. You take it home, you put it in the NES, and it's an awful game. They got my money, and I'd take it back on time at least. But hey, packaging is powerful, folks. Mike, we're going to have to bring on your dedicated packaging pro. That'd be a great conversation.
He would love to come on and chat. I mean, he is all about packaging.
We're going to have to make that happen. Fascinating stuff. Okay. So now, as we're in kind of the home stretch here, we're going to check in on the final master's category company. And that is Unilever, who is supporting an outstanding initiative that successfully engages startups to help solve some of global supply chain's greatest challenges, especially from a research and development standpoint. So it's called 100 Plus Accelerator is this initiative. It's an interesting program that was created by Anheuser-Busch InBev, and it's co-sponsored by four other fast-moving consumer goods, you might hear that acronym, FMCG, fast-moving consumer goods companies, Unilever, Coca-Cola, Colgate-Palmolive, and Danone. The program focuses on successful matchmaking between tech startups on one hand, with companies looking to innovate new solutions, on the other hand, especially those that address global issues across supply chains and R&D. Now, the top matches, rather, earned the startup a $100,000 pilot project. That dog will hunt, Mike. Now, Unilever reports that its most successful pilot that's come out of this 100-plus accelerator program has helped one of its nutrition factories in Poland reduce machine cleaning times by 20%, cut utility use by 10%, and it saved 100,000 euros a year. Mike, I tell you, I love to see new ways that companies of all sizes, but especially those in our global supply chain industry, that find new ways of leaning into the startup space to do big, big, innovative things. Your thoughts here?
Yeah, I think this was another article that was fascinating on multiple levels. I mean, I think you've got to recognize that for most organizations, the ability to create, drive, foster innovation is there, but it's not, for most organizations, it's not their sole purpose for being around, right? Unilever's job, their mission statement is not around creating new tech and new ideas. It's around satisfying customers, right? So the fact that you've got companies that are solely in business to drive innovation, to come up with new ideas, to understand their viability and scalability, and finding a way to bring those two groups together, I think is fascinating to hear about. I was reading through the article. This is, I think, to me, the poster child for a win-win scenario, right? Mm-hmm. You have an organization like Unilever has an opportunity to look at and trial different technologies. You've got young up-and-coming or, you know, early stage organizations with ideas that they want to understand. Is it a good idea? Can it scale? And being able to pilot something, say at Unilever or Danone and some of those other companies that you mentioned, is not only a great way to see if you've got a good mousetrap, but can the mousetrap scale? Mm. And can you monetize the mousetrap? Which is probably at the end of the day, on the entrepreneur side, really what they're trying to understand, right? So the other thing it does, if you think about, again, companies' reasons for being, the Unilevers, the Danones, are not to be tech startup companies, right? This brings incredible value to those types of CPG companies because you have folks that are in business to drive innovation and create new ideas, and that's their sole purpose for being. So we're talking about it today from an FMCG perspective, but I would encourage any industry that is not overflowing with IT budget, i.e. retailers, to start thinking about how can we find these partnerships? How can we find these types of brokers that are going to put in front of us really, really smart people with some great ideas? How do we get involved in this to see if there's a way for us to start taking part in these? So I tend to have some fun with my friends in retail, but retail is not the only industry that's not flush with IT cash. This is a way for any company in any industry that has, let's say, a limited budget for things other than running the business and keeping the lights on. This is a great way to start to play around in some new and emerging technology, A, to see if it works, see if it works for you as a company and an industry, and get access to it early. So J&J does something similar in terms of how they think about funding projects, right? A very entrepreneurial type of approach. I think the other message, the last message I'll leave people with is, you definitely need to be thinking differently about how you're going to find and foster innovation. And yes, this to me is a perfect way to do it.
Excellent commentary there. And I almost wholeheartedly agree with everything you shared. We've got to find, blessed are the matchmakers, blessed are the bridge builders. This creates value, to your point, very holistically for all parties. So we'll see. I'll look forward to seeing what comes after the pilot projects, like the one I mentioned some of those results. But good stuff. So good on you, Unilever and its fellow sponsors that are engaging the startup space. Okay. Coming down the home stretch, Mike, I want to mention one of the things that's coming up next at Gartner, and that is these popular planning summits. This one here, you've got London in November 2025, and you got Denver, and the graphic I'm sharing here, coming up in December 2nd and 3rd, right around the corner. It's going to be here before you know it. So tell us, Mike, we talk about these a lot. These have really grown in prominence amongst the rest of the Gartner stable of programming. Why should folks check out the planning summits?
Scott, we've talked about, you just came back from our symposium series, right? And that's really targeted at CSCOs, chief supply chain officers, their direct reports. And if you think about kind of the balance of content, it's really about 75 to 80% really strategic, thought-provoking. 25, maybe 30% is kind of hands-on tactical stuff. And that's by design. It's by, based on who do we think is going to be at the event. We think about our planning summits, it really is designed for people that do planning and people that run planning organizations. So you're going to see more like a 50-50 split between that kind of strategic, thought-leading stuff and actually hands-on type of activities for planners, right? Things like S&OP, demand and supply planning, all those types of things that are much more tactical. You and I joke about the symposium is the world's largest gathering of supply chain professionals. I don't know that I can say that yet about planning, right? But I can tell you that in one spot or two spots, depending on London or Denver, you're going to find one of the greatest concentrations of planning expertise that you could find in any one two-day session. So highly encourage people with an interest in planning, doing planning, running planning, and owning the planning responsibility to at least give it a look and see if there's things there that that will pique your interest. The one shameless plug I will add for this year's planning summit, we added a track specifically around talent in org, which my team is responsible for. If you've wondered, right, how do we motivate planners or how do we think about structuring our planning organization, we've now got some very specific talent planning content that we'll be sharing in both venues. So I'm excited. I think this is going to be, two really, really good events for us.
Outstanding. So I got to ask you, who has the rowdier happy hour? Is it the symposium crowd or the planning crowd?
My sense is it's the planning crowd because most of the bosses aren't around, right? You don't really want to go crazy if your CSCO is like three tables over. So for the most part, I think what you'll find is I would argue the planning side. If we ever, though, open up a logistics summit, then all bets are off. All bets are off when it comes to logistics people.
Love it. Folks, check out the planning summits. And along those lines, Mike, how can folks connect with you?
Yeah, LinkedIn, or just drop me an email. Happy to hear what's on people's mind. If there's anything I can help with, any questions they might have, just reach out and I'm happy to connect.
Outstanding. And that email is?
Mike.Griswold@Gartner.com.
Okay, it's just that easy, folks.
That easy.
Mike Griswold, Vice President Analyst with Gartner. Mike, always a pleasure. Really enjoy these conversations. You had me at the VHS Wayback Machine, I think you called it. I was feeling every single memory you were sharing there, but enjoyed your expertise and take, as always, across these other stories. Thanks for being here, Mike.
Thanks for having me. Looking forward to next month.
You bet. Folks, hope you enjoy this conversation as much as I have. Mike brings it each and every month, but you got homework as always. It's one thing to enjoy the conversations as much as I did, but you got to take one thing from that Mike shared here today, share it with your team, put it in action, find a way to operationalize it, right? It's all about deeds, not words. That's how we transform how global industry and global supply chain take place each and every day. So with all that said, Scott Luton here challenging you, do good, give forward. Be the change that's needed. We'll see you next time right back here on Supply Chain Now. Thanks, everybody.
Join the Supply Chain Now community for more supply chain perspectives, news, and innovation. Check out supplychainnow.com, subscribe to Supply Chain Now on YouTube, and follow and listen to Supply Chain Now wherever you get your podcasts.